yourself. Logic Podcast. Two guys with no credentials.
Reviewing Rolling Stone 500
greatest albums.
Hello, friends. Welcome to Sound Logic Podcast. Today we are discussing album number 79. I can't believe we're closing in on number 80 here.
it's exciting.
This is Blonde by Frank Ocean.
Yeah, I'm really excited. First of all, that you're here with us. Thanks for joining us once again. And I don't want to talk about it too much now, but Ben, I'm really excited because this is a really a brand new artist for me entirely. And there's something really thrilling to me. I mean, I could go, you know, I could go online and just find artists I haven't heard of. But, you know, to have something that's, you know, acclaimed like this and that we're studying with a little bit of intensity and that it's brand new and we've never heard it is pretty cool and fun. And so it's been just listening to it in the last few weeks and preparing, doing some minor research has been pretty neat and exciting and a new experience. So I'm kind of pumped in that sense.
Absolutely. Well, and I think the other piece of this, and we kind of fumbled through it a little bit at the end of the last episode, but this is a genre that we haven't really ever tackled here in this project too. So not only is it new to both of us, and pressing play for the first time is always exciting, it's like uncharted waters. We've got nothing really to compare it to. I mean, there's maybe some peers, but, and we'll get into that, but it does really sound different than anything we've tackled so far.
So with all that said, I think we need some details to get started here.
Perfect.
Details. Okay, so Blonde was released August 20th, 2016, so it's less than 6 years old. Written primarily by Christopher Bro, that's the birth name of Frank Ocean. He's now officially legally changed his name to Frank Ocean. It charted very well when it came out. It debuted number one in the US, number one in the UK, and went to number one also in six other countries. To date, it sold 1.3 million copies. And, you know, as we get to these newer releases, Ben, the charting gets so, or not the charting, the sale, the units sold gets so interesting, right? Because it's not just about album sales anymore, which was the way we did it for years through LPs and then cassettes and CDs. It was all, you know, an album. And now with streaming and digital downloads, it's, I don't know how they tabulate it all, but and physical album sales, of course, have gone way down. So we don't see some of the big 5 million, 10 million, 12 million, 20 million anymore, really, even for some of the popular releases.
Right.
But anyways, 1.3 million in less than 6 years is certainly nothing to laugh about. A very successful album.
Right.
A few notes on the album, and I encourage you to, you know, go listen to some Frank Ocean, learn about Frank Ocean. If he's a new artist to you, he certainly is to me. He's a relatively new artist. This is his second album. This is a follow-up to his highly acclaimed 2012 album, Channel Orange. So he announced not too long after, in early 2013, that he was working on a new album. And he did. He started working on it, and it took him over 3 years to complete it. It was, for a long time, the project was called Boys Don't Cry. And I think that's obviously very appropriate, because there's a lot of the themes on the album really reflect Ocean's personal journey, and it's a very personal album. The themes in the album around him dealing with his masculinity, emotions, inspired by his sexual experience, heartbreak, loss, trauma, you know, references to relationships, to drug use, to mental health issues, all sorts of stuff, and it's very you know, I'm not saying that everything he says is a personal anecdote, but it feels very, very personal.
Yeah, including words from his mom, of all people. So, yeah.
Now, is that an actual recording from his mom?
Apparently.
Okay, okay. I hadn't gotten that far, because there is an interlude track where it's a voice. It sounds like a voicemail from his mom about the dangers of drug use in college.
Yep.
on a track called Be Yourself. So, yep, The Boys Don't Cry, you know, I think because he deals with kind of the ideas of masculinity and gender and all these things. Now, you mentioned earlier this is a new genre for us, and I'm wondering what you meant by that, because, you know, when I first listened to it, I said, well, is it pop? Is it R&B? What is it? The album's been categorized as avant-garde soul. Is that what you were referring to?
Yeah, well, and really, I mean, we've certainly referenced hip-hop albums. We've certainly had some R&B and some, you know, rap, including gangsta rap. Mm-hmm. And all of those elements would be present here, but this really doesn't sound like anything we've tackled. And I avant-garde soul is not something I'd seen, I don't think, until I saw the Wikipedia entry for this album.
But right.
I think it helps crystallize something in my mind that I was like, I don't even know what to hold this up to. Like, maybe Kanye, maybe Kendrick. It's not even a fair comparison to hold him up with those two folks, although, ironically, they're both involved in the creation of this album.
Right. and you know, it's a good time to mention many, many, many people involved in this album. Well-known people, mostly on the production and writing side. Pharrell Williams, Kanye West.
We've got James Blake.
Right.
We've got Beyonce on a track. There's samples from the Beatles,
mm-hmm.
Stevie Wonder. There's work here by Andre 3000 from Outkast.
Lots of other people who I think are well known in the industry. Tyler the Creator, who I've certainly heard of, I'm not as familiar with him. And a guy who shows up on many tracks, Buddy Ross, who is someone I'm not familiar with. But anyways, like I said earlier, he's the primary songwriter for pretty much every track, but also almost every track has, you know, someone else. A guy named James Ryan Ho, better known as Malay, is on, you know, probably half a dozen tracks. So yeah, lots of guests and many people contributing to this album. There's a high production value,
which is fascinating for an album that feels really, really stripped down.
Yeah, it does at times, doesn't it?
Most tracks just have one melodic instrument or sample. They're not very layered. It's not like there's a whole bunch of instrument tracks, and yet there's all these people involved. And I, you know, it makes me wonder, like, I can't pull out the Beatles reference on White Ferrari. I didn't know it was Beyonce until I figured out which track she was on.
You didn't hear the Beatles thing?
No.
Spending each day of the year from
so it was
here,
a lyric.
Here, there, and everywhere.
It was a lyric, or it's not a sample?
It's not a sample. It's what they call an interpolation. He lifts just one line from that song and puts it into a verse. The line, I don't think he uses that melody on every verse in the song, but on that, I think it's like the third verse, he uses that melody in just the line before that, and then does that. And as he sang it, I thought, oh, I know that. That's from Here, There, Everywhere.
We're getting dangerously into our thoughts about the album, but
I know.
The contrast of someone like Kanye, who, you know, retreats to Hawaii or wherever and just keeps inviting people to make each song fuller, more robust, more complicated, more complex. It feels almost like Frank Ocean invites people in, gets just a little tiny bit of them to like a little dusting of seasoning on the top of the track.
Right.
Very, very minimalistic and stripped down in comparison. Really interesting. But anyway, we'll get more to that later on, I'm sure.
Yeah, along with that, and I made some notes here, but I think it's appropriate to talk about them now. You mentioned that very stripped down. I noted that four or five tracks have percussion, and the rest don't. So it felt very almost ambient, lots of atmospheric and environmental sounds. Frank Ocean has listed influences for the album. Brian Wilson and the Beach Boys, the Beatles, of course, Stevie Wonder, we mentioned all those. So lots of kind of older influences.
Yeah, you know, and recorded at Electric Lady Studios and Abbey yes. Road Studios, which is wild.
Yes, amazing. Yeah. I could hear some newer influences, but I'll talk about that a little later. So when the album came out, received widespread acclaim. Critics praised Ocean's introspective lyrics and the album's unconventional and progressive sounds. Critics also complimented the album for challenging the conventions of R&B and pop music. And certainly there's no doubt it's very different compared to what was coming out at the same time. Time magazine named it the best album of 2016, which is pretty impressive that it came out in August. So it wasn't like it came out in January and they'd had the whole year with it. And in 2020, Pitchfork named it the best album of the decade. So lots of accolades there.
How this album was launched definitely made me feel a little old.
Okay.
And I'll say a bit more about that. The album, as you mentioned, took a while to create, was referred to originally as Boys Don't Cry. What happened was a live video was launched on Apple Music, which showed an empty music hall. It sort of like spurred a bunch of fan reaction and wondering what Frank Ocean was doing. Is this the second album? And then there were like videos of people coming in and doing woodworking and randomly playing instrumentals and things like that. Sort of at the end of this weird live video, it was announced that that was part of a project called Endless, which was a 45 minute long visual album.
Right.
That sort of led then to sort of the fans thinking, oh, okay, so we've got what he was working on. This is it. And it wasn't it. It was sort of like a little fake out, because then the album came out just a little while later.
Right.
And I just think that's so interesting, the sort of like the double take. And I think that the album was released exclusively in iTunes, not Apple Music.
Okay.
So, you know, we've talked about the shift through time from the different packaging and ways that albums are recorded. I don't know that we've had an album yet that didn't come out, at least on release day, in some physical form. It was just right. Just an iTunes album.
Mm.
So wild to think about that, even for guys who still like to think about themselves as somewhat young.
Right. Yeah.
It just feels very modern to just say it's going to be an Apple Music exclusive. So yeah, you know, those things I think set the context for this really is a more modern album, just in terms of the way it was put out there into the ether. Feels very different than most of what we've talked about so far.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm still getting used to some of these new and creative ways to release music and groupings of music. And Frank Ocean's another artist who has just released a lot of different, you know, singles and visual albums and music videos and all this other stuff. It's very interesting. He's obviously a very creative artist. So speaking of creativity, we get this very interesting album cover. Again, I guess even in the digital world, you still need an image
yep.
to go with your music. So we have one here. The first thing that I noticed, and please, if you're not familiar, just go and Google the album cover. First thing I noticed is that Blonde is spelled without an E. Now, everywhere I can find, you know, whether it's on Spotify or Wikipedia or anywhere on the internet, the album is, you know, when it's listed anywhere, is spelled the traditional way of spelling Blonde, B-L-O-N-D-E. But on the cover, in all lowercase, it just says Blonde, B-L-O-N-D, no E.
Mm-hmm.
And I couldn't really find anything on that. I don't know if you found anything. Why that is. On top of that, it's an image of Frank Ocean on the cover, and his hair is dyed green. Not blonde. Now, I know it refers to not just the hair color. There's a different idea there. But it's a pretty compelling image. Frank Ocean, a close-up of his face and upper body, his hand covering his face. You can't see his face at all other than his forehead.
Mm-hmm.
He's in front of a tiled wall, which makes me believe he's in the shower. There's water droplets on his body. We could imagine perhaps he's crying or, you know, which again is that, you know, the whole, I think up
Boys
to
Don't Cry,
up to very close to when the album was released, I still think it I got this sense that it was going to be called Boys Don't Cry. So the fact that he's crying on the cover, or could be crying on the cover, is, you know, again, just this flying in the face of the traditional masculinity and all that stuff, right?
Yep.
And the lighting, the light is directed from one side, you know, from his left side, so it's very harsh shadows on his right side. So it's a very compelling image. That isn't the whole cover. That's just a picture. It's almost a vertical 1:2 ratio, almost.
Yeah,
you know, a narrow image that I guess would fit into our TikTok world now that everything's just a vertical image now. But it's kind of centered, and it's just a light gray on the outside of that border on it, and then underneath is a barcode, and I'm not sure what that bar
on the front of the album.
on the front. But I think that's very intentional. And I was reading somewhere, I think that has something to do with Boys Don't Cry as well. And then in other images you'll see beside that is the parental advisory.
Yeah.
There, which I guess isn't part of the actual art, but is there. Anything jump out to you on this, Ben?
The other weird thing about this album, as if there wasn't enough little oddities, is that there's an alternate cover.
Oh, right.
Of him wearing like a race car suit at a track.
Yeah.
Still spelled blonde without the E on the end, but you can't really see his face. And
no, he's got a helmet on.
Because you can't see him crying, I don't know. I'm intrigued by the cover of him with the green hair. It almost makes me think like a blonde hair dye gone wrong or something like that.
Sure,
that's why
yeah.
he's upset. You know, to sort of just look at it really surface level. But for an album that tackles identity, sexuality, space in the world, conveys a lot of emotion.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, the spelling of blonde aside, it does really like pull at something there when I look at it, and it's really interesting.
Absolutely. And it I'd have to be honest, it had me intrigued.
Yeah.
You know, as I you know, clicked on the album and saw that and click play the first time, I was like, boy, what is this? You know, what's going to happen? Yeah. So, yeah, really, really neat. And I think we've talked about, you know, some covers that just don't match the album at all, or we just can't figure out what it has to do at all with the album. This one, as abstract as it is, it does fit very well. I think also he has like a Band-Aid on his index finger.
Oh.
It looks like a Band-Aid.
You're right. Yep.
And, you know, another... I'm not sure if we've seen this before. Like, you're a solo artist, and you know there's so much like ego and all that stuff, and it's and you're right on the front of the cover, and you can't see his face. Like, you know,
yeah.
It's so different. It's so it contrasts other ideas of solo artists, of R&B artists, hip hop artists for sure. You know, on the front with you know. New baseball cap and gold chains and, you know, grill and all the, you know, a car, all this stuff. And this is very different to that.
Yeah. Yep.
Are you ready? You ready to get into the music?
Yeah.
Of this?
Yeah, let's dive in.
Like I said before, I had no idea. My only point, I have one point of reference. I'm a pretty big, or for a long time, I was a pretty big John Mayer fan, meaning I bought every album until maybe his most recent album. I think I bought everyone. Pretty much right after it came out, and it was his sixth album, Paradise Valley, that has like an interlude track that features Frank Ocean, and it's mostly just like a vocal interlude, very little instruments, with a beautiful vocal from Frank Ocean, and you know, I'm like with Wikipedia and liner notes, I love to read, you know, oh, who's singing on that? Who's playing guitar in this? What do I hear? I was like, Frank Ocean. And I never really looked him up, but I just... So when I went to listen to this, all I knew was that he was a vocalist. That's it.
Yep.
Nothing else. And there's something refreshing about that, because I feel like almost everything we're going to listen to, we've developed some sort of bias through just seeing a video, or it's a meme, or or we've heard it on the radio, or there's a the artist is in the media for doing something stupid, or or you know, they wore this at an award show. And for me, to not that I'm have my finger on the pulse of pop culture, but we're so inundated by it. To come across something that you really have no point of reference for is kind of refreshing. To listen to it with unbiased ears. So that's what happened for me. I pushed play and I was like, I have no idea. And when I did push play, it was very, very different. And and I've said this before, but the biggest thing was just how stripped down it was. And I know you had asked me and my wife had asked me and other people, like, what do you think of this album you're listening to? Because they know I listen to albums for the podcast. And I think what I said for the first few days was I really don't know what to do with it. You know, we're as people, we're trying to, our brains are programmed to try and categorize things and put them places, especially males. We like things in boxes. You know, we like to put things in our minds. And I was like, I don't know where to put this. I don't know what this is. And, you know, which is funny because I said to my wife, it's funny that we feel the need to put something somewhere to enjoy it instead of just saying, I like this. You know, whether, who cares what it is, like, or where it belongs, so to speak. Do you like it or not?
Yeah.
But where we have this compulsion to say, but where does it belong? where does it go? So that was, I think, the first hurdle for me was, like, just didn't know. And I think a big thing was, you know, having no percussion on so many of the tracks and just feeling a little lost at times. I feel like a lot of the songs were not particularly melodic. I wouldn't say they had no melody, but didn't have, you know, that hook that we expect in a pop tune.
Yeah.
In the same way, or like, you know, that Kanye West with, you know, these riffs and samples and all this stuff that just grab you. This is not that. So that was the first thing I noticed.
Yeah. Can I say a little something along those lines?
Absolutely. Before I keep rambling.
I felt the same way. And so I went on YouTube to hear other people review this album.
Oh, okay.
And I came across a channel, which I thought was kind of a neat idea. A younger, maybe late teens or early 20s kind of dude sits down with his dad and presses play on his favorite albums to get his dad's take on it.
Huh.
And his dad said the same thing you just did. I don't know where this belongs.
Hmm.
And the more I listened to it, the more I thought, yeah, he's playing with time signature. He's playing with song structure. He's playing, like, a lot of the songs start out and you expect them to build to a bigger crescendo. You expect the band to come in, or you expect something else to start to happen. And
when's the beat going to drop? When's it going to drop?
Yeah.
And it never does.
Almost every track on this album plays with our assumptions,
right? Yeah, that's
in a way that I think is really clever, but also leaves me feeling uncomfortable because it almost sounds like something and then it's not. Like he leads you somewhere and then like pivots, and just when you think you might know what pigeonhole to put him in, it goes askew. And you know, that first track, the album kicks off with Nikes, right?
Nikes. It's the only single from the album.
The only single, and he's got his voice smushed through like a high-pitched helium sample that sounds totally different than the rest of the album. And I thought, like, the very, very small idea I have of Frank Ocean does not make me think, like, Tiny Tim, high falsetto. Is this really who he is? And then the next track is totally different.
Yeah.
It's almost like he is aware of what we want him to be and just takes a step back from that all the way through. Just enough to like play with your assumptions. And
I like that.
This father-son duo who are we reviewing it, the son said, just give it some time, Dad. I felt just like you the first listen, and it has taken me a long time to sort of really start to appreciate some of these songs. And I've found that too. I think I've only made it through this album maybe three times, but every listen has been better. And I don't think it's just because it's more familiar, but I think it's because I'm starting to see with each listen how he's playing with me. And and I'm intrigued by that in a way. I don't know that I like that manipulation. I'm impressed by his genius, and I see what he's doing sometimes, but I crave a bit more familiarity in it as I'm listening. So yeah, I think exactly what you said is spot on, and it's taken me a while to kind of unpack maybe even more of what that's really about.
I love your insight there, and that you know, kind of, I never thought about it that way, kind of teasing us,
yeah.
playing with our expectations. And I think you're totally right.
Even genre-wise, like, yeah, psychedelic pop,
yeah.
is that one of the avant-garde soul, psychedelic pop?
Avant-garde soul, which is, I never heard of that.
There are moments where I think better comparison would be like Bon Iver, like really stripped down modern folk rock.
Some of it, for sure, yeah.
You know, because he is really a vocalist, and he is a minimalist when it comes to sounds alongside, and I think there may even be I think that Beatles inspired track White Ferrari fades out with the lead singer of Bon Iver doing a fade out. So it's the
oh really?
It's not too much of a stretch, yeah. But there's things here where just when you feel like you've got the genre figured out, it, you know, the next track feels even more different. Like, yeah, it's really fascinating.
I wanted to come back to what you said a little bit about the first track, Nikes, and the voice through the pitched up through the compressor there. And I heard a lot of contemporary influence as well. So right off the bat, you know, Kanye with that chipmunk soul that he, yeah. I wouldn't say necessarily pioneered, but certainly got popularized in the early 2000s. And we heard that, you know, To Pimp a Butterfly starts with that.
Yeah.
With the voices all modulated. I heard a lot of Drake. You know, a lot of the Drake goes a lot back and forth between rapping and singing or singing through auto-tune.
Yep.
I think Drake would be probably a rapper first. Frank Ocean is more of a vocalist first, I think. But a lot of the way he delivers is more rap or spoken word.
Mm-hmm.
So I hear that, Drake. I hear Justin Timberlake, you know, in the vocals. And you know, it was in, I think, 2006 when, I've talked about this before, when Timberlake came out with Sexy Back, which had that, it was all modulated. That was one of the first hits that had a really modulated vocal. It was kind of like this, I remember hearing, I know I said this in another episode, hearing him say, like, this is the future. And I was like, are you kidding? No way. And now it's all, like, almost all of it, you know, and not just, you know, not just touching something up with an auto tune or just, you know, just, we've done that for years, but totally changing the vocal. It's like really, really popular and trendy, still happens all the time. So we hear those influences throughout it, you know, the older ones, the Beatles, all that stuff, and then the newer ones as well, which is really, really cool.
Yeah, it's so interesting the way that he weaves that all together. We talked about a rhythm track, drum kit being so absent. When it does come in on the third track, finally, there's some familiarity, but it don't really feel like we ever get to a chorus on that track. So it's like, finally, we've got the song structure that I imagine this should have, but it never kind of like completes itself. and then you get to the next track and you're like, oh, okay, we're back to no drums again.
Yeah. I find it very brave and courageous.
Yeah.
And also a lot of patience.
Yeah.
I'm surprised that Solo wasn't like the hit single, you know, because I think Solo is such, it's got that feel, but like I'm listening to going like, I'm sure they had a beat on this at some point. Like it almost deserves.
Almost sounds like it wouldn't have been that hard for him to be an Usher style R&B singer to just fill it out the way everyone else does.
Absolutely, and even in that track, like it's not even like, you know, there's something very rhythmic, like a bass guitar or a heavy left hand on the piano or acoustic guitar. It's all kind of like pads on the synth.
Yep.
Just moving, that moves the tempo along. Yet I feel like if I close my eyes, I can put a beat in there, like it could go in, and you could easily have done it, and he didn't. Like, it's such a bold statement.
Very intentional.
Extremely intentional. And again, very I think very brave. But that's I'm surprised, and that I did remember what I was going to say, talking about influences. And you hear some of the rhythmic influence of an act like Outkast, and Solo has
using the voice as an instrument. You mean like?
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, and just the way that Outkast with their, you know, they're known for being one of the fastest rappers I got both of them, really.
Yep.
But when you listen to their stuff, certainly all their stuff, but their early stuff too, coming out of Atlanta, and just that Southern style, very different. But their way of using rhythm, syncopated rhythmic lines, not, you know, not just the standard kind of thing, very, very different. And then, of course, the reprise of that song, Solo, is really more of an interlude, but featuring Andre Benjamin, Andre 3000, rather. His performance and his style fits so well on this album, because he's also a guy who you know, he's again probably a rapper first, but he also sings. But when he sings, like on a track like Hey Ya, which is, you know, one of their biggest hits, it's somewhere between rapping and singing. And I feel like Frank Ocean does that a lot on this album. It's rhythmic, almost like a spoken word, and it's got a tonal quality, but it's not like rapping, which is sort of just a lower, almost monotone. And some rappers play with pitch a little more than others, but this is almost going the other way from, you know, a traditional vocalization on its way to a rap delivery, but stuck somewhere in the middle. And Andre 3000 comes in with a verse that's not just a straight hip hop verse, but it is melodic, but it's still not really a vocal singing line. It's really well done, and lyrically, and we haven't got to the lyrics yet, because as we're not really lyrics guys, but he says solo a lot on the interlude, but it's, if you were to spell it out, it's the two words S-O-L-O-W. I'm so low that I can, etc., etc., etc. It's just, it's very well done. I mean, there's some, again, albums we've listened to where they have guests on that just complement the feeling of the album so well. And I was just, the first time I heard it, the first, you know, maybe 10 seconds, I didn't even realize that it was someone else at first. Because I was like, I was just vibing along, like, yeah, because he does different things with his voice, right? Throughout the album. Yeah. So it wasn't out of place to me. You know, you're over halfway through the album. And then I was like, hold on, that's not Frank Ocean. And I listened closer. I was like, wait, that's Andre 3000. Hang on a sec. You know, like, wow. So yeah, that was something that was kind of a highlight on the album for me, and really, really, really well done.
I really thought, Mike, that the first time you brought up Solo was going to be to say, this is the first slide whistle we've had since Bob Dylan.
Is it a slide whistle?
I don't know. There's like this wild whoop kind of sound that just interjects almost randomly.
Do you have someone in your family really who can do that? Like put their two fingers in their mouth and whistle?
No.
I felt like someone in your dad can't do that, can he? No.
Oh, maybe my dad.
But I think everybody has met someone in their life who can do that thing where they put two fingers in their mouth and do that. That's what it sounded like to me.
Yeah.
It could be a slide whistle.
We'll draw some parallels here, since this album isn't weird enough to Bob Dylan.
So lyrics. We should probably, as much as it's something we usually gloss over, we should talk about it. And I will say, similar to you, how it took me a few... I probably listened to it all the way through, maybe three or four times, and then come back just piecemeal a few times. But it again took me a few times to get into the lyrics, because like some hip-hop albums with us, there are just a large amount of lyrics, first of all, but it's... They're very... There's a lot of different themes.
Yeah.
And when you get into things that are kind of personal reflection, it can be kind of abstract, too. Nothing's really... There are some narrative moments, but nothing's... Or it's not all a straight narrative. And it touches on some kind of vague ideas that people could relate to, you know, like, you know, going to a party or crashing on someone's couch or, you know, doing some shrooms or, you know, all sorts of other things, being in heartbreak. But then there's some specific things, like when the one track I really like is called Nights, and there's almost like a second part to it. I was reading the lyrics, and lyrically there's a lot of consistency, but musically, about two-thirds of the way, it kind of totally switches musically. But in that second part, he talks about a lot of things that specifically people have gone through, like when Katrina hit, I had to switch campuses. And, you know, sleeping on your... on your mattress when I didn't have an address, you know, and, you know, doing what I could do to get out of Texas. He touches on at least that one instance and other things, very, very specific points in recent American history.
Yeah.
That I'm sure many, many people could relate to.
We've talked a number of times about how authenticity seems to make, it seems to always be an element of a great album. And I think the inclusion of like the voicemail from his mom fits well with an album where he gets pretty personal at times.
Yep.
There are some points where it almost feels like he's talking about some things with some lament. It's not just like a gangster rap album that's like kind of glorifying, you know, sex, drugs, rock and roll, or life on the streets, or spinner rims, things like that. You know, there's some like some tension in some of the things that he's singing about, and I think that like voicemail from his mom where she's telling him like, don't just be your own self, don't do drugs, don't listen to what other people want you to do, and, you know, chased by some songs where he's sort of like looking back almost retrospectively on his life, wondering if he did the right thing, makes it almost feel like biographical in a way that artists aren't always as transparent as what we're here.
Yeah,
it's really
that posturing,
pretty vulnerable. Yeah, it doesn't feel like swagger, it feels like a lament almost, at times at least. And
that's really
an interesting choice. Again, feels like a very intentional one.
Oh, for sure,
to do that and to hold that as we go through. The other piece about the lyrics that I was surprised by is there's a lot of references to God, not always like the most uplifting, but lots of like religious language.
I did hear some religious language for sure,
and I can't always decipher what he's referencing when he includes it. Again, it also feels very intentional, like woven with, there's a line about like long year or something like that.
Yeah. That is from, is that Skyline 2? Making sweet love, taking time till God strikes us.
Yeah.
That's a pretty effing fast year flew by. That's a pretty long third gear in this car. You know, it's just like.
So there's like some awareness of a divine something out there, but it's like often sort of mixed in with, you know, making love and driving fast and regret, remorse. I don't know. It's a really fascinating kind of blend of themes.
One thing I picked up on at least two tracks, and this is one of them in Skyline 2, he mentions the summer a couple times in this track, and in at least one other track, I felt like that was a theme. And especially for, I mean, Frank Ocean's, I'm not sure how old he is when he releases this. I think the summer, especially for young people, is there's just a lot of tropes around the summertime, right? Like,
yeah,
like it's kind of a magical time because it's a break from all your routine. All sorts of different things happen. You go on trips, you go to camp, you get a different job, you hang out with your friends, you know, you have romances, and then the end, there's a lot of songs about the end of the summer, right? Because it could be very abrupt. And I think so he's actually not that much younger. He's only 5 years younger than we are.
But he was in his late 20s when he put this album.
Yeah, he would have been. He would have been in his late 20s and still, you know, some of that youthfulness. And so I feel like just that idea, the theme of the summer, tied in with the kind of the emotional themes and relationships and wrestling with your emotions and your mental awareness comes up a lot. Yeah, I didn't pick up on the religious talk as much, but I'll have to go back because that's another thing that I wanted to say, not necessarily in conclusion, but as we move through it, like I feel like there's still so much for me to glean from this album. Like I have listened to it as much as I can in the last little while, but I feel like there's still a ton to discover. And I think the biggest part of that for me is the lyrics. Like, it's an album where I want to go through and read them. Like, you know, I don't know about you, but a lot of times if I'm like, I listen to it at work a lot and, I'm doing other stuff on the computer and I've just got it on. It's not the best time to just sit and read the lyrics. My employers probably wouldn't appreciate that either.
Sure.
What'd you do today, Mike? Well, listened to an album and read the lyrics the whole time. But no, there's just a ton of different themes. There's as you're talking about, you know, him talking about God and not always in a positive light, I was thinking there's a lot of different words I could use to describe this album. Happy is not one of them. Or, you know, joyful or hopeful or, you know, pretty much almost any positive word. It's not always directly, you know, depressive or, you know, here's this horrible thing that happened, but it's all very, you know, it's definitely got a kind of a downer feel to it.
A bit melancholy.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. That feel to it. And with the music too, you just, it's just kind of this kind of looming, floating kind of thing. Instead of, there's not a lot musically that's very sharp or hard, right, Ben? Like, it's not like, it's all very gray. Not blonde, gray.
Yeah. Yep.
I think that's about all I've got on the music. I mean, I could ramble on, but it's very, in conclusion, for me, it's very compelling, it's very interesting, it's very thought-provoking, and it's extremely different, especially for me, and I think for you as well. Which is exciting.
Well said.
So one thing we haven't done yet is pick our favorite tracks. If you're new to this podcast, we have a playlist on Spotify. It's called Sound Logic Favorites. We pick two tracks from each album we review. We got to pick two from this one. Ben, do you have one in mind? I don't want to put you on the spot. Although I guess at this point we should know this is coming.
I think Ivy is my choice.
Oh, okay.
I don't know if it's just getting off of the falsetto of track one, but track two always like pulls me in a way that track one did not, and starts to get me into the album. You know, we often highlight that a lot of these great albums have really good tracks to kick things off. I'm not sure that I'd say that about Nike's, although it does paint a picture that this is going to be something a little different. I think it's that longing for something to make a little bit more musical sense for what I think is musically sensible. Ivy feels a little bit more than that. Although there's some wild vocalization at the end of that track that really does step outside of the norms.
Right.
But I'll go with that one.
I actually have had a hard time picking one. I will give honorable mention to Pink and White. Okay. To Nike's. I gravitate toward a lot of the tracks with a drum kit in them.
Pink and White, just for our listeners, is the most listened to track on Spotify for this album, so it is a popular one.
I think it's maybe the most radio friendly, the most poppiest of them. I like Skyline too. I like White Ferrari with the, you know, the Beatles. That's from my favorite Beatles album, so I've got to I got to mention it. I think the one I'm going to go this way. The one that's been stuck in my head the most is Solo, and I was actually surprised after listening to the album a couple times when I went and usually I'll listen to it first and then go and do some research just so I can kind of listen to it with virgin ears without having any kind of bias or reading anything about it. I was sure that Solo would have been the lead single. It just kind of had that feel, and I feel like it feels like almost a focal point of the album, almost like it got a lot of the components. With, you know, Pink and White is almost too different than the rest of the album. Like, it's kind of a standout pop tune. But that doesn't really reflect most of the album. I feel like Solo does that much better. And I think it represents the album as a whole very well, both musically and lyrically. So, I'm going to go with Solo. I like Ivy, perfect, too. That's good. And the open... Yeah, it's... I like you, Ben. It's growing on me. Like, it's really growing on me. Like, it's... I want to listen to it more once I'm done kind of, you know, the kind of academic exercise of it. I'm not sure how much I will come back to it necessarily. I think I might for some tracks, but it is really, really growing on me in a way that I really didn't think it would. I think it reminds me of Kendrick Lamar's To Pimp a Butterfly. The first time I listened to it, I was like, is this what hip-hop is now? You know, even though it was like already 5 years old when I listened to it. Right. But I was like, I'm not a hip-hop fan to begin with, even with hip-hop that I'm familiar with. You know, when we listen to, like, Wu-Tang, you know, and even Kanye, yeah. I was like, yeah, I don't, this has got me out of my element. And then to listen to that, which is just, like, just so new to me, and just so different from everything else for the last 20 years in hip-hop. I listened to the first time, the first three tracks, and turned it off because I was like, I don't even know what to make of this. And I don't think I'm going to like this at all. And I kept listening to it, and then it really grew on me, but it took a while.
Yeah,
and it's actually one that I will come back to from time to time. Every once in a while, I'll go, yeah, I haven't listened to Pimp a Butterfly in a while. Let's put that on. Sometimes I'll just pick and choose a few tracks. Sometimes I'll listen through the whole thing. But it's one I have come back to from time to time. Again, it's not my favorite album. It's not one that I have a lot on. It hasn't really inspired me to listen to the rest of his catalog yet. Although we will do some of that through this project. But it really grew on me. And I think part of it is that it's so compelling. And I get this a very similar... I feel like... I'm going through it again with this Frank Ocean album that it's like it's taken a while, but it's really, really growing on me.
Yeah, I can see that.
So it's if you're into Frank Ocean, if you're into music like this, it's probably one you really enjoy. If you kind of listen to some R&B, some pop, some hip hop, I highly recommend that you check this out and give it more than, I'd say give it a shot. Give it more than one shot. Like, listen to it a few times. Listen to it and put it away and come back to it a few days later. It's there's a lot waiting here for you. But we have a little more to talk about. As much as I feel like we're winding down, we have a few more things to go through. And one of the next questions we ask is what has aged well and what hasn't? And I almost feel like it's a little too recent a release to really talk about that.
Right.
Because we're kind of still in this moment where a lot of these sounds... So I guess the question is, well, it's still very relevant because a lot of the sounds and ideas, and certainly ideas around... More with kind of the lead up and more of his personal life, I guess, than specifically in the album, but ideas of gender and masculinity and, you know, sexuality and sex and drug use, you know, like, you know, even in Canada the last few years now, marijuana is legal. So this new generation's coming up don't have the same stigma around, you know, recreational drug use that even we have.
Right.
And we hear a lot of these ideas coming through. So I think it's, as much as it hasn't aged much, it has aged well because a lot of it is still just very relevant. I think the biggest thing is that even in its context, in its time, it's very, very different. So it'll be interesting to see. And I guess the other question in this instance is, how do we think it will age? and I'm not sure. I don't know. What do you think about that, all that?
My hunch is that history will view this in the same way that we view something like the Velvet Underground.
I knew you were going to say that. Yeah, absolutely.
Maybe not that something we come back for comfort, like, oh, I really love the Beatles' Sgt. Pepper's album, so I'm going to go back just to feel those warm fuzzies again.
Yeah.
But this will be something that inspires people for generations and makes them think outside the box and beyond what's possible.
Absolutely. I totally agree. So we come to the question, the namesake of our podcast, was it Sound Logic? Now this is the 79th best album ever.
Yeah.
What do you think about that?
I was surprised to see this one here. I had heard a little bit more from my peers, a little bit more chatter about Channel Orange, his debut.
Okay.
I was surprised to see this one come up first because I hadn't heard much about this one. We're about to turn 40 this year, so it's not like I'm young and hip and with it. Just the fact that I said that probably ages me some.
Yep.
I don't really know whether this feels appropriate. I don't love when albums get included for the way that they've inspired others. Like, I want them to be both inspirational and great and comforting and something to return to. And I get the feeling a very, very few listens that this is an album that pushes people to imagine what else music can be. not necessarily an album you just sit back and relax to. That makes me hesitant to say that it's deserving of like a top 100 ranking. I don't know. I'm it's making me want to go to Channel Orange now and see how they compare. I know it's coming up, so we will eventually get to that one too.
Right.
I guess I'm fine with it here. A younger generation proved to me why it should be here. And we'll leave it at that.
Right. When this list was released, this album was just 4 years old.
Yeah.
And there were some other albums that were even younger, but they appeared later in the rankings. And I think the best thing we can compare this to is To Pimp a Butterfly, which came out in the same year, which is ranked number, I think, 19. As much as I was a little surprised to see an album so recent be in the top 20, I saw the ripples it made in kind of the racial equality movement, justice movement, just still showing the differences in treatment of black people in the U.S., drugs, sexuality. I saw those themes so overtly, and they really made an impact. I mean, we talked to Daryl Foster, and he was like, yeah, this is family cookout music for us. And I said to him, really? Like your parents and your aunts and uncles and your grandparents? Like, oh, yeah. Like, we love this stuff, you know, like a song like All Right. Like, it's like a theme, not to sound, make it sound hokey or cliche, it's like a theme song, you know, it's a rallying song. So I saw the impact of that, and that makes sense. I don't quite see that here. We see the critical acclaim, we see how innovative and how it pushes, you know, some of these cultural ideas, and lyrically does that. Musically, it's very different. If you listen to us, you know, we don't preliminary research. We don't spend hours and hours and hours researching and interviewing. We do a little bit, mostly through Wikipedia. Okay, so I didn't see a ton about artists saying how much it influenced them, but there was a lot from critics saying how impressed they were with it, how they felt it was bold, courageous. Other artists saying, you know, they were proud of him for expressing his feelings and his personality through the album. So I think that's really important. I still struggle with it being quite so high, even top 100. I think I would have been comfortable with it. And I expected albums like this to be further down. You know, albums like, you know, Billie Eilish's album and Harry Styles' Fine Line, you know, both from 2019, you know, less than a year old when the list came out. Further on down in the ranking, that makes sense, because like, this is going to make a difference in the next few years. Like, we are anticipating that when we do a list again in 10 years or even 5 years, that these albums, people will be voting and saying, this is one that affected me big time. And to have this one here at 79, I feel like it hasn't quite had that. It hasn't, as much as To Pimp a Butterfly did in the same time span. I don't know that this
maybe has. It has. So, maybe we're just not in the right circles. I mean, it's hard to say.
I was just going to say, I'm happy for people to tell me I'm wrong and tell me why. I have no problem with that. And that's why, you know, it, again, we didn't really pursue a guest super hard on this one. It would have been nice to have someone a little more in tune with it to help us out. But it feels a little high. But again, in a few years, it wouldn't shock me if it, more and more stuff like this comes out. More people say, you know, it inspired me to make this album, you know, and that album becomes like. And hey, it was a number one. Like, it went to number one, you know, in eight countries. Like, it's not like it wasn't successful. It was. I guess I'm just struggling. I haven't seen it or read it or whatever. So I need someone to show me that. But there's certainly a ton there. It's just some things take a little while for their influence to really permeate. And then when it does, it's so obvious. Like, you know, even you mentioned the Velvet Underground. And then like 10 years later, the punk movement and the post-punk movement and all that stuff coming directly from what the Velvet Underground did, you know, in 67. maybe we'll see something like that, but that's just speculation.
Yep.
The last thing we like to talk, are there any other albums? And he's only released one other album. And you mentioned his debut in 2012, Channel Orange. It does appear not too far away, 148. So maybe in the next couple of years, we'll get to that one. And I am curious as well, because I think that right away after his first album, you know, the next year, he's working with Pharrell Williams. He's working with Andre 3000 and Kanye West. So that had to be groundbreaking enough to get the attention of these other people, right? Yeah. And you said you've seen more commentary on that album. So I'm very curious about that one. I haven't listened to it yet, but I'm excited. And we'll talk about Mr. Ocean one more time. Oh, and that's the last thing. This is your last tidbit before we go. His name change is directly inspired by the 2001 film, one of my favorites, Ocean's 11.
That's where I was going to make a joke at the beginning of the episode about how we're reviewing an Ocean's 11 soundtrack. And that's too late.
But he has gone on the record to say it his name changes directly inspired by that movie. Wow. So there you go. We hope you enjoyed it. We hope you come back next time. What we got up next week, Ben?
Next time, we'll be revisiting an old favorite. We'll be getting back to our high school punk music days when we tackle 1977's Never Mind the Bollocks, Here's the Sex Pistols by, of course, the Sex Pistols. It comes in at number 80 after taking a 39-spot hit from the old list. But we'll revisit that review, and we'll see what new thoughts we might have as well.
Featuring our special guest, your seminary professor, Mr. Barry Taylor. So we're looking forward to chatting about that a little bit and re-releasing our review. Until that time, we hope you continue to be well. We hope you take care of yourselves and those around you. And of course, we certainly hope you'll join us next time right here on the Sound Logic Podcast. Thanks for listening, everyone.
If you like what you hear, subscribe on your favorite podcast app and write a review.
Send us a message at our Facebook page, on Instagram, or through our SoundLogic Podcast Twitter feed. Thanks for listening.